wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio, and it is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this June 10th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. In part two of a two-part discussion on public education, Bill Resnick returns to talk with teacher Rachel Haynes about the pedagogy of the three second grade classes at Glencoe Middle School while still managing to sufficiently satisfy the various corporate education requirements. Part one can be found on the Old Mole website, kbu.fm, and that discussion also looked at teaching and the challenges faced with the heavy loads teachers are saddled with. I will talk with Mark Brenner, also a follow-up to an earlier discussion on the PERS crisis, quote-unquote crisis, that aired on May 27th, also available on our webpage. We'll look at PERS post-vote and discuss where we go from here. Clayton Morgridge will talk about freeing up the time of our lives, which sounds like something we all need. And I will also be back to talk with some folks from DSA, Juliette Milan and Evan Birchfield. We're going to talk about a Pride Night event coming up on Wednesday this week, June 12th. That's part of Pride Week, and it's at the Funhouse Lounge. We'll talk a lot more about that. But next, let's move to Bill Resnick and Rachel Haynes.
Hi, Rachel Haynes. This is our second part of our conversation.
Hey, Bill.
Yes. Rachel is a great teacher at Glencoe Elementary School. Last week, we talked about the difficulties of teaching these classes full of kids with different skills, different levels of development, all of them needy, of course, at age 7. Rachel spends more time per day with them than their parents by a long shot, without any help, and having to deal sometimes with really difficult problems in kids. And meet the school's requirement that these kids all come out with higher math scores than the kids in Japan and Singapore and other places, not to mention everything else that corporate America thinks is important for teaching our children. Rachel tries to help people think and live together and respect one another, as well as do sufficiently well on reading tests. And in fact, you probably, Rachel, do better. Your kids are going to do better because they aren't being standardized and forced into all of this sort of meaningless learning, because you sort of embed the things, learning skills and problem-solving skills, in your curriculum.
Well, there's no way to know that, and I've put very little stock in standardized testing. So the thing that's valuable to me is when I have kids in middle school come back and say they remember certain projects or units that we did that they still have the artifacts from in their house, and that's much more meaningful to me.
That must be wonderful, having the kids come back, that you could have a relationship like that.
I'm not going to say it happens all the time.
Well, I'll bet you must see kids on the street, too, remember, right?
Yeah.
A good teacher also is so important. Let's talk about your teaching and as you pointed out, the amazing teaching that's happening across this city, even in the schools defined as failing schools, schools.
I've worked at a quote-unquote failing school, and it was an amazing place with a lot of teachers going above and beyond daily and an amazing community. I mean, that's the thing. Those tests don't measure anything about family and student engagement and the kind of teaching that's going on. The worst part of that is it creates this label of failure with people who are working so hard, often against incredible odds, and it's a complete disregard and disrespect for the work that they do, both teachers and the students and the families. So a couple things that I know are true is some of the best teachers doing some of the most innovative things are teachers that listen to and respect student voice. So I know that the climate justice work and ethnic studies work all came out of students really fighting for these things, to see this kind of curriculum in their schools and the teachers that support and encourage those kids fighting for those things. But the kind of stuff that's happening in our building, you've heard of the Black Lives Matter Week of Action that happens in schools throughout the country now. It's built. It started in Seattle, but it has built out to become a national movement, and it happens every year in February. And this year, there was a committee that came out of PAT that really worked to put this on through the schools. But the kind of curriculum that is being shared across from teachers in D.C. and Philadelphia and Seattle, I mean, it's a network of really great lessons and teaching and artwork and materials to support this week of action. And we did that all over the district and with support of principals and even the district to some degree. But we were teaching really important lessons about solidarity and empathy and community, but all through a racial justice lens around Black lives really mattering and what that looks like in our schools and in our society. So that's just one thing that's happening around the district. I think the climate justice work also happening around the district to a much smaller degree, just because I don't think there's space and time and institutional support to allow that to happen in every classroom, but that is the goal and the aim of the resolution. But in our own school, I like to teach the storyline method, which is you create questions that you're trying to answer, large-scale questions. The whole unit, it's an interdisciplinary unit, and you create a world that you inhabit. So our whole second grade team at Glencoe does a neighborhood storyline, and we create a neighborhood. It has a name. We talk about what would the most welcoming neighborhood look like, what would be in it, what services would be available to people, and we create this neighborhood, and everyone creates characters that live in the neighborhood and work in the neighborhood. We have city council elections. And then we have a series of events or incidents that happen, and the community comes together to decide how to deal with it. So one of the things that my brilliant colleague thought of was to have a oil company offer jobs and money for them to have us allow them to put an oil pipeline through our community. And then we learn about what impact that would have, and we learn about fossil fuel extraction and all the leaks that have happened and what that does to the environment, and a bit about global warming and what we can do to stop it and transition to renewable energy. So this is second grade, and they love this, and they are just hungry to learn about all these things and apply it to...
And apply it. I mean, yeah. You could teach math in a variety of ways, right? Like just temperature and...
You know, I've never had a class that had kids voting to have the oil pipeline go through our neighborhood. But then we talk about, if not us, who? So we talk about what it means to divert from one community and have it impact another community. So then we start thinking about kind of our responsibility to fight something so that it doesn't impact any of us, not just us. And we also always, every year, have a family move to our community from another country, and usually it's based on something that's happening in the news. So it's been family from the Marshall Islands who are climate refugees, family from Syria fleeing from war. You know, we've had one year it was Japan after the tsunami and the nuclear meltdown. So we study that country and we think about how to welcome them into our neighborhood. And just as an example of how real and meaningful this is for kids, this year when we learned about immigrants and refugees and asylum seekers, and one of the kids came in and said, I think we should do a fundraiser for IRCO, the organization here in town, to raise money to support families that are coming to Portland. And the class raised $300, I think. Kids would bring in spare change. They brought in money from their piggy bank. Parents chipped in. And they got to write letters and send this to a real organization doing real work that they wanted to support. And they have a sense of what it means to recognize other people that have needs that are different from their own, and how to support and welcome everyone in our community. You know, the kind of conversations happening in our school are, we talk about racial justice, we talk about economic justice, we talk about
gender justice.
We have a timeline in our classroom that has things on it, like, you know, when gay marriage was legalized in the country and when Jim Crow was ended. I mean, we study all kinds of real life, real issues that kids feel very strongly about.
Yeah. Within that, there's also a process that I'm sure you do that is not you at the front of the room lecturing these kids.
Right.
Right. You're not standing there for 6 hours and 20 minutes with their computers and taking down every word so that they can feed it back to you at the end of the year in the exam. That's not the way you do things. It's group-oriented. It's kids teaching kids. It's very democratic, too, right? Kids have an opportunity to work with others and probably to challenge you, right?
Oh, yeah. For sure.
I hope they do.
They do.
Yeah, do they?
Yeah. We have.
You must love that.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, it's great. We have really wonderful debates. A lot of the conversations that occur are things that are brought up by kids. So it's like a lot of the things that we've explored and learned about have emerged from student voice and student conversation. And there is a great wealth of children's books out there. I think that we're in a kind of a golden age in terms of subject matter and the kind of people that are being represented and struggles that are being represented.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah. So reading a book about a particular person's struggle, Malala, Cesar Chavez, the janitor strike in LA, there are all these like wonderful kids' books out there. And they have questions. Why is it like that? How can they have people working for that little money? How can they use pesticides that make people sick? Why is that legal? Why is that okay? And so a lot of these conversations come from their very real questions and concerns in their own sense of what is fair and what is just. And through that, we explore how things are established legally and through political process, but also how people organize and fight to make things better for their own lives. And that resonates with kids.
How do you deal with the differences between kids and their willingness to stand up and express themselves? I mean, you have some who are really eager to be heard, eager to to present. And then you have some kids who are shy and some who are withdrawn and some who have trouble listening. How do you deal with those dilemmas? Some kids could really stand out.
Well, there are a few things. One thing is every morning we start with a morning meeting where we're in a circle and we greet each other by name around the circle so that everyone feels welcome first thing in the morning and seen as a person, as an individual. And so starting from the very beginning of the year, first we share more light, superficial things, your favorite animal, or if you've ever had a pet, if you have a sibling, you know, just get to know you stuff. Mm-hmm. But then as the year goes on, and we're talking about bigger and bigger ideas and getting to know each other more, we talk about, you know, what do you do if somebody is being unkind to you? Or what do you do if you watch somebody being a bully to someone else? And we talk about real scenarios, real things that they're actually dealing with. And kids always have the opportunity to pass if they want to. So there's no forced conversation. We start every morning with a morning meeting, and every afternoon we end the day with a community circle. There are kids that it takes a long time for them to start to share in community, but eventually I've always had kids, even the shyest kids, start to share because they feel heard, they feel respected, and like their voice matters. And in that moment, we have a little talking piece. They are the only one that gets to talk. So there's a real respect for each individual getting to share their feelings about a particular subject. And just the other day, I was like, why is community circle important? That was the question. And kids said things like, we get to speak from our heart and know that it's not going to leave the circle, that this is a space for us to share with each other. They say things like, we get to know each other better. We get to develop empathy for each other. I mean, these are 7 and 8 year olds, and the amount of care and respect that they have for each other because we create space for that every single day. And that's how we start and end our day. So I think that is crucial to building class community in my class.
Carries over into the next day then. Kids learn how to be democratic, actually, and mm-hmm. how to engage.
Mm-hmm. We actually talk, too, about step forward, step back. If you're a kid that doesn't talk very much, sometimes try to push yourself to speak from your heart. And then kids who like to talk a lot, take a step back and create space for other people. I mean, it's really, really challenging for 7-year-olds not to talk all over each other. I won't say that,
I'm
like,
sure.
That is an easy task, but it's something that we work on every single day. Respect the speaker, be a good listener, listen with your ears, your heart, your whole body, right? It's not just not talking, it's actually listening to the person speaking. And so I try to center every child who speaks is equally deserving of your full focused attention as any teacher that's speaking to you. So that's part of it. And there are kids that are, they're more introverted, they're more shy. We have small group, we have partner shares. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways that throughout the day we give space for people who prefer a more intimate conversation to the larger group conversation.
Every kid should have the opportunity to be in your class, it sounds to me. But there are a lot of teachers who are doing that. That's the interesting thing. What you're doing now is, my guess is the product of support from a decent administration of the school, support from other teachers. When you entered, there were all sorts of other teachers. You were sort of one of the new people, right? That's how it works in schools, right? Teachers do help teachers.
Oh, yeah.
Support from the union that has fought to give you some room in the classroom and has disciplinary procedures so that a bad principal or vice principal or whoever can't just silence you and get rid of you quickly. You have powers and fights for teacher capacity to work together.
I also think when you're doing things that you know are right, if you're fighting for what you know is right, which is to put the student first, to center the student and not the test score, to center the kids that are in your class and not some expectation created by somebody who has no idea what you or your students are trying to do every day, then it's easy to do right by your kids if you know what's right. And I think, but you're right. It's like it takes time in the system to know how to push back and to know how to fight for your kids. And it's harder when you're a new teacher, I think, to understand that.
Although, even if you have good values and know what's right, translating that into pedagogy or curriculum and developing the storyline and knowing when to have kids in a group and when to do it as a whole group, what ideas to introduce. You, after all, are the leader of this year's. I mean, a teacher is a skill, right? I mean, it's a series.
You're all constantly growing and reevaluating and changing. I mean, it's just in some ways an amazing profession. There's no end to the growth that you can make as a professional educator. Everything from restorative justice classes to the storyline class to reading and trying to improve my own practice. Yeah, it's just ongoing.
Rachel Haynes, this has been a revelation, actually. This is very moving. On a daily basis, almost, when a shy kid suddenly begins moving towards feeling better about themselves and being able to speak and express themselves, it must be very fulfilling for you, right? When all of those moments, in fact, there's probably so many moments of the day when you feel, oh God, but there's probably other times when you feel, wow, this is just it's just wonderful what's happening.
I do think that what we do every day in schools is a pretty wild, crazy social experiment. I mean, we are in a room of, up to 30 individuals who are learning how to move all together, learn all together, do everything all together, which is completely unnatural to spend an entire day as a big unit doing every single thing together and have to learn how to push ourselves or be pushed, and also how to support each other and negotiate like very real conflict and tension, because we don't all have the same needs at the same time. But in that process, a beautiful thing happens. I mean, we develop a community that loves and cares for each other. I mean, every year I cry at the end of the school year, even the hardest class that I maybe am like dying for summer break so I can get some emotional and mental release, because it's been a hard year. I love every one of my students, and I'm sad to see them go. And it just feels like a really strange and special thing that we're doing every teacher does every year. And I mean, that's part of the thing I wish people understood about teaching, is the amount of emotional investment and care and concern for our students every year for so many kids. It's just like, when I really think about it, it feels almost, it feels monumental what teachers give of themselves because they love their students so much. And we get so much back from that. But it's a really big part of the job that I think a lot of people don't understand, is the every year there's a little loss, We have to lose these children that we've invested so much in and we care so much about, and then we set them free.
And you also know all the challenges ahead for them.
Yeah.
Which is all daunting and sort of...
Yeah. The hardest kids are the kids that are closest to my heart, They're the ones I continue to worry about. They're the ones that I think about for years to come. Teaching is a pretty wild experience, to say the least.
But it's really also wonderful in a lot of ways. You're doing work that's meaningful and that you want to do despite all of the testing and the corporate sort of demands and all of the rest of it. It's a privilege to have work that is, in fact, in some ways so important and fulfilling.
Yeah.
I would think. Rachel Haynes, a teacher at Glencoe School, This Monday, you'll be going into your class. Six hours and 20 minutes starts. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Bill.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO.FM. That's 90.7, listener-supported community radio. Later on the Old Mole, we'll have Clayton Morgridge talking about freeing up the time of our lives. And I'm your host, Denise Morris, and I'll be discussing an upcoming Pride Night event at the Funhouse Theater. And I'll be talking with Juliet Milan and Evan Birchfield, both involved in organizing that event and are also members of Portland DSA. So we'll be talking about all sorts of good stuff. So stay tuned for that. Next up, I have on the line Mark Brenner. Mark, are you out there?
I'm right here. Thanks for having me, Denise.
Oh, well, thanks for coming back to do this PERS follow-up. Unfortunately, we won't be talking about great victories, but hopefully we'll be talking about future victories or how to win them. As we know, our supermajority failed miserably. I don't know that anyone's super surprised by that, Mark, but let's get into this. We have just a short amount of time here to kind of unpack what's happened and where we go from here. You've really maintained that this is a manufactured crisis, and yet in all of the post-vote reporting, that tidbit of information doesn't seem to be trickling down. What do you make of this no vote? Here we have senators and representatives talking about having heavy hearts and this terrible day and backed into a corner. What do you think is going on here with the fact that so many Democrats voted for this bill?
I can't help but think about the 1980s in Great Britain when Margaret Thatcher became prime minister. And began to slash and burn public services there. She said that there was no alternative. There is no alternative. It became an ideology in that country and really an ideology around the world that there was really no choice but to take these painful actions against public employees and against public services. And I feel like that's really what we're seeing here in Oregon is the triumph of that mindset, that there's really no alternative to this. And unfortunately, it just doesn't square with the facts. PERS has been very healthy for most of its history, and up until 2008, it was 100% funded. And then, like most financial programs, the Wall Street collapse of that year took a huge bite out of what was sitting in the bank for the PERS fund and left the fund about 80% funded. But even that has been much better than what we've seen in most other states. I think a friend of mine told me that Oregon ranks 17th out of 50 states with our current PERS funding level at 80%. So this is, you know, not a relative to other states, relative to many private sector pension funds. PERS is definitely not in crisis, but, you know, there is a section of our political class that is eager to destroy PERS and get rid of any kind of social collective, you know, security system, whether it be for retirement or healthcare. And so they're winning the battle for hearts and minds on this, because even people who are sympathetic to teachers and firefighters and public employees are telling the same story that you just said, that, oh, this is terrible, we really just don't have any choice.
Right. And interestingly, and not to pick on just one senator, there's been an immediate response to kind of tackle this problem of who actually does serve in our state. I find it interesting that Rob Nose, I think is how you say his name, who is actively or has been actively a union representative for ONA, Oregon Nurses Association, actually voted for this bill. So there's no real... doesn't seem like there's stable ground, you know. He could even be a secret socialist, but he still voted for it. This is a very troubling situation, and it looks like folks, including DSA, are gearing up to try to begin the process of running other candidates. But before we talk about what our solutions are, what our game plan might be, I just was hoping you could sort of lay out your thoughts about what will the actual impact be.
Sure. Well, the bill that got voted on in the state Senate, SB 1049, does a lot of things. But there are two things in particular that really matter to Oregonians. The first is that let me back up for a second. In 2003, whatever problems PERS had in terms of long-term viability, they were addressed with the creation of a third tier, which I'm a part of, in PERS. And since that time, the long-term trajectory for PERS has been quite strong. But what that program did to sort of offset the pain for future employees like myself was to create in addition to your defined benefit, your traditional pension, they created a 401k style individual account plan that everyone got, and the state or the city or the county would contribute 6% of your salary to that, and it would grow over time. And so then you'd have a kind of an offsetting market-based individual retirement plan for about 70% of the people that work in the state and for cities and counties around and towns around Oregon. Their employer, the state or the city, puts in that 6%, and for about 30%, they contribute it themselves. And so the biggest thing that SB 1049 does is it takes a portion of that money, which was always destined to be yours and yours alone, and it diverts it to the general PERS fund, to the general pension fund. So if you're a Tier 1 or a Tier 2 employee, that's it's taking 2.5% of your retirement contributions into your individual account and putting it into the big pot. And if you're, like me, a Tier 3 employee, it's only taking 0.75%. So in the first year that this takes effect, which will be July 1st, 2021, that'll add up to about $150 million that would have gone into retirement programs for state workers and city and town workers, and that'll be put into the big pot of the general PERS fund. And by year five, that total amount that will have been diverted will be worth about almost $900 million. So if we're looking over 5 or 6 years into the future, this adds up to over $1 billion that would have been directly paid to state workers in terms of individual retirement benefits, 401k style benefits, which is now being put into the general PERS fund. Their general PERS traditional pension is not going to go up. So it's a pretty big blow to the retirement incomes of state workers, who really don't need this. I mean, think about the fact we're talking about 6 years to get up to over $1 billion. The kicker for this year is going to be $1.4 billion. So, even in this biennium, they could have covered the total amount that individual workers are putting into the PERS fund through this give back that the state legislature adopted with just a quarter of the kicker. So, for progressives, for people who want more equitable revenue and tax policy in the state of Oregon, we're losing pretty big, pretty substantially here. This is a big blow to us because the whole debate was premised on the idea that in order to raise money for schools, which we saw with the Student Success Act earlier in May, the only way that would go forward is if the Democrats simultaneously punished state workers and cut their PERS. So, this puts us in a situation where at best, it's three steps forward, two steps back. But I think, for many of us, it feels more like one step forward, two steps back.
And lawsuit? We just have about a minute and a half. Is this illegal? Do you foresee any sort of legal action over the next couple of years before this takes effect?
I think there's definitely going to be legal challenges. I think, unfortunately, too many unions are probably resting their hat on victory in the courts because that's been the pattern here in Oregon. We've been able to defeat most of the PERS reforms that have come forward in the state legislature, but I'm not convinced. The Supreme Court in the state, just like everywhere else, is a political body and definitely has its finger in the wind. So we'll see what happens, but I the lawsuits will come. Whether we win them or not, I certainly wouldn't hold my breath.
So that means we got to get in the streets and build the build our networks, build our movements going forward.
Absolutely. And as you said, Denise, I think it really raises the question about, you know, if we can elect a supermajority of Democrats in the state and still suffer, you know, because it's not like public services are doing fantastic under this Democratic regime. I mean, we're seeing hundreds of teachers being cut from school districts around the Portland area, you know, all kinds of city services being rolled back because the funding is not there. So if this is what happens when our friends are in power, who knows, you know, are they with friends like these, right? Why do you need enemies?
Right, exactly. And a great note to, not a great note, but a sage note to end on, Mark. Mark Brenner, thank you so much for joining us again. And we will look forward to talking with you in the future.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Denise.
All right. Thank you. That's Mark Brenner, who is now working at the University of Oregon at the Labor Education and Research Center, formerly director of Labor Notes for many years. We're going to move on now to Clayton Morgridge, who's got something to say about freeing up the time of our lives.
In this commentary, I'm going to be drawing on Martin Hegelin's book, This Life, Secular Life and Spiritual Freedom. If we had all the time in the world, if we were immortal, then it wouldn't matter how we spent our time, for there would always be more of it. But if life is short, then it matters a lot. If everything and everyone we care about is finite, if we and the people we love are mortal and can die at any moment and will die at some moment, then every day and every minute of our finite lives is supremely important. How then should we arrange our lives together so that the time of our lives is well spent? In view of our mortality, wouldn't we want to spend as much of our allotted time as possible doing things we want to do, that are worth doing for their own sake, and to minimize the time we spend doing things we have to do? There is the realm of freedom and the realm of necessity. The realm of necessity is what we have to do, whether we want to or not. It includes the activities necessary for maintaining life, cleaning, caring for children, the ill, the injured, and the aged, building and maintaining dwellings and infrastructure, and growing and preparing food. All this belongs to the realm of necessity. Now, some people may enjoy this work, but it has to be done, whether we enjoy it or not. The realm of freedom, on the other hand, consists of the activities we choose to do, because they are valuable in themselves. Athletic activities, art, music, literature, science, and philosophy are examples. The realm of necessity is unavoidable in any society, stuff that has to be done regardless of whether anyone would choose to do it. There are different ways of getting people to do such work. The Greeks and the Romans built their empires with the power of people they enslaved. So did American capitalism. Thus, citizens, especially the elites, were free to engage in the arts, sciences, and of course, politics. Then there are various ways of tying the lower classes to the land, as in feudalism and sharecropping, in which what peasants produce must be shared with the upper classes, again leaving the well-born with time to pursue what seemed to them most valuable, such as explaining why God wanted things to be this way. Does capitalism give us all the right to choose how we shall spend our time? Well, capitalism got its wealth in the first place by means of slavery in the U.S. and the Caribbean, rapacious colonialism in Africa and Central and South America, and the dispossession of native peoples in the U.S. and elsewhere. Wage labor, though, became the primary way for capital to make money. But although wage labor is called free labor, to set it apart from slavery, it is more perceptive to call it wage slavery. Whatever job we do for a wage becomes part of our realm of necessity, not only because we have to do it to stay alive, but because while we're at work, we are under the dictatorship of our employer. Even the owners and managers of capital, in spite of their wealth, are not free from the demands of capital, which requires them to grow their capital by ceaselessly competing for investment opportunities. More land, more resources, more labor, and more consumers to exploit. Where can you rest your eyes on things and activities that are not in some way exploited by capital? Like a cancer on the living earth, capital sucks everything, including the time of our lives, into its grasp, to the point that the survival of life, and certainly civilized life, is in question. Is there a way of organizing a society that would expand the realm of freedom and shrink the realm of necessity, so that more of our time would be our own and not under control of others whose interests are opposed to our own? Let's consider democratic socialism as it is laid out in Three Principles by Martin Hegland in his book, This Life. First, we make it the purpose of our society to liberate our time from the realm of necessity, to expand the time in which we do what we individually and collectively choose to do. Second, the means of production, the goods and resources we need to maintain our lives together, must be owned and managed democratically, for otherwise we do not control the valuable time of our lives as the first principle requires. The third principle is familiar. As W.E.B. Du Bois phrased it, the effort to give all people what they need and to ask of each the best they can contribute, this is the only way of human life. Unless we trust that our needs will be met, we cannot freely choose how to spend our time, and we cannot know that our needs will be met unless we cooperate in meeting these needs to the best of our ability. And what we need is not only what we have just to live, but also what we need to flourish, and flourish together. We need the means to develop our abilities to do the things we find satisfying, and the abilities to work together as citizens of a fully democratic society. Such a society will reduce and transform necessary labor in three ways. First, a great deal of necessary labor can be done in the realm of freedom, when we no longer have to worry about making a living by selling the time of our lives to others. Childcare, gardening, and architecture are socially necessary activities, but many people love to do them for their own sake and would do so in a free society. Second, the problem with unpleasant but necessary labor today is that those who do it because they need the money in order to survive. And that makes it hard to identify with the social purpose of what they are doing. In a cooperative society, socially necessary labor is shared by all members of society on the basis of their abilities and commitments, with the explicit purpose of contributing to a common good that everyone can recognize as making their lives better. Third, since we all participate in necessary labor, we will all have good reason to develop and deploy labor-saving technology, whose purpose now would not be to eliminate jobs that people need, but to decrease and enhance the quality of the time we spend doing things we have to do. In capitalist society, most people at some level feel alienated from a society in which so much of the short time we have to live must be given over to doing things that we do not choose to do. We cannot feel at home in a society that is governed economically and politically by forces unconcerned with our welfare. People do what they can to carve out a personal spot in this unfriendly space where they can feel more or less safe and comfortable, although many millions of us, some of whom you can see living on our streets, are unable to achieve even this. But very few of us feel any sense of owning or belonging to this society. Democratic socialism will be the first society that is truly of the people, by the people, and for the people. And only such a society has a shot at not perishing from the earth. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. Wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like
Thank you, Clayton. And you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That's 90.7 FM radio. And we are listener-supported community radio. Thanks for all of the folks who became members and re-upped recently. You can always do that on the website at any time. It's a great place to support. I'm Denise Morris, the host this morning, and I am here with two guests. I'm excited to have folks on this morning. I have Juliette Milan and Evan Birchfield.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm working off my computer today because my ink ran out on the printer, so oh, no. Bear with me as I roll through here. I wanted to just do very brief introductions and then have both of you talk about what you're doing and how you kind of came to the work, because you're doing some exciting stuff with the DSA Queer Caucus and a big event coming up this week to offset the corporate madness of Pride. So, Evan, you are originally from Medford, and you've been in Portland for over 6 years now, and you've become involved with DSA and, as I said, with Queer Caucus. And Juliette, you identify as queer trans woman living in Portland most of your adult life.
Yep.
That's good. You're a Portlander. And you became involved in queer organizing a couple years ago. I want to have you tell this, but I like this idea of Ask a Trans Person Anything booth at a Central Oregon Pride. Will that be happening again this year?
No.
Okay.
I don't have time, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's okay. You probably have other things to do than answer those questions. But why don't you go ahead then, start to just say a little bit more about what you are up to in your political and comedy career here.
Oh, yeah. I am a comedian, allegedly. People do pay me to show up on stage and do it on purpose, which is not a step that every comedian gets. And that's pretty cool. I wanted to say thank you real quick for getting my name right. Not everybody does that, so...
Really?
Yeah.
I thought about asking because I thought I could be different, but...
No, you nailed it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, way to go.
Right. Excellent. I coach
people and they get it wrong all the time. Yeah, so I came out as trans and started transitioning in 2016, almost exactly 3 years ago, which, you know, was great timing on my part.
Yeah, right.
And as soon as after the election, I knew that I didn't want to hide from the world or be afraid. I don't respond well to fear, and I have an antagonistic response to it. So it really motivated me to go out and be seen and heard and talk and educate. And I know that if I'm not going to advocate for me, no one else is going to. And that's where the first steps were, doing the booth at Central Oregon Pride, really, really came in. So, yeah.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Evan?
Yeah, so I've always been obnoxiously political for like most of my life, and but that's gone on. It's been an interesting journey of, you know, being raised conservative, dabbling in libertarianism for a while, just becoming a young adult who's not knowing what's right at all, and then finally, eventually, going through the phase of liberalism, which was really a space and time where, and it's, I've heard people say that liberalism and neoliberalism is a mental disease. I can account for that. I was blaming myself for all the problems that I was having in the world. You know, there's some things that are on me, but not this situation of don't have wages, don't have healthcare, don't have the ability to actually, you know, survive in this world. So to actually get over them, it was, unfortunately, I think that we respond to crisis in the world more than we actually respond to actual like enlightenment. And it was the election of Donald Trump. And I'm just grateful that I did not go the other direction of fanaticism towards like hoping Robert Mueller is going to save the world for us or something like this. This is instead I found myself in DSA, took a little time, but I found myself in DSA. I got involved with some other activist groups along the way. And this has been a place where I actually believe we can build power. I believe we can challenge power. I believe we can take power back.
I have a hard time visualizing you as a neoliberal.
It wasn't pretty, I'm not going to lie.
Or a libertarian, I can kind of see. Actually.
Okay, ouch.
Yeah, no, it's the facial hair.
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah. No, the beard was along for the whole ride, so
the beard comes with the transition. Yeah, the transformation.
Yeah, right.
Mine didn't.
Right. But. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got just a few, but yeah. Well, let's jump into with the time that we have to talk about the Queer Caucus in DSA. I thought it was had been kind of around for a while, but it's a new caucus, and and you've been very active in building it and being present and out there with some suggestions, let's say, for some people.
Yes, strongly worded suggestions.
Yeah, strongly worded suggestions and related to Pride, which then will bring us to our comedy event that we'll talk about later.
Well, I would say that the Queer Caucus really started getting formed. Well, DSA was growing so much last year, and that was because we had people. We were in the news a lot. There were things like Occupy ICE that was largely started here in Portland, but it became a nationwide movement. We also had the just the election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for better or worse, and mostly better, sometimes worse. But we saw so many people join DSA, and along the way, I met with a few queer people who, like myself, wanted radical queer activism to be a part of this city. And there are other groups who do things along this line. There's groups out there, and I don't want to say that they're not doing that work, but within DSA, we needed this. We have socialist feminists getting together. We have the formation of a POC group as well within Portland DSA, but queers were not as active. So we did that work. We laid the groundwork, and we've been trying to build community, reach out to people. When there were attacks against queers earlier this year, we saw that as another responding to crisis. We had an opportunity to pull more people in. We met so many great comrades that way, and now we have,
including me.
Yeah, including Juliet. That's how we met Juliet, through the community organizing that was going on in the months of February and March.
Awesome.
So yeah. So we've, as a result, we've created, I think, a really sturdy militant group, and I'm excited about what we're doing.
I'm not militant.
You could be, though.
Don't say that. It ruins my cover.
Yeah.
Did you have anything to add about the caucus?
I did want to talk about the letter, because I think that what was said in there is so important, especially right now. And it's, Pride itself is literally under attack right now throughout the country. And so when we're coming in and we're giving this messaging, and it makes it sound like we're unappreciative of the work that's been done. And that's not true. What we want is actual representation, and for it now more than ever, for these events to be about the community that they're supposed to be representing and protecting. It's specifically because neo-Nazis are interrupting Pride parades with police escorts that we think that police shouldn't be at Pride. Especially the Portland PD and how they've been responding, how they responded to the attacks earlier this year, and how they've actively been sort of, there's been evidence that came out of them collaborating with alt-right groups, and that right there is a non-starter. Like, how do you do that and decide to march? And so it's addressing that hypocrisy, and not just from police, but also from corporations that want to market to us, but not represent or protect us.
Yeah.
I was in Target recently, not to advertise Target, but, you know, I needed my toilet paper and my mouthwash and a couple things. And I ran into a Pride display, like full on clothing and everything. And I thought, what planet am I on? Mm-hmm. And even in all my years, that was sort of a new thing. And I began to realize I was seeing this all over the place. Mm-hmm. So there's, on the one hand, there's this presentation of Pride commercially that has been really a part of Pride for decades, you know.
Rainbow capitalism.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Exactly. So we have just about a minute and a half. Let's talk about the comedy event, because that is what we want people to visit upon this week.
Right. We are putting together DSA's first comedy show, I think.
We may have co-hosted one before.
But. Okay. But it's at Funhouse Lounge this Wednesday at 7:30. Tickets are $12 online right now. You can go to bit.ly/2019pride, which is an awesome domain, and you can get them right now, or you can get them at the door for $15. It's going to be awesome. There's going to be the DSA there if you want to learn more, and more than anything, it's going to be a fun event where we're going to be unashamed of being queer and being, you know,
radical.
Radical.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Funhouse Lounge is a great place.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, they do some great stuff. I had an opportunity to do to see a couple things last fall, maybe it was, but it is a really great venue. So,
and Andy, the owner, is a superb human being. So.
Right, and
as far as I'm aware.
So, is there? We have just maybe about 15 seconds. I guess perhaps we should just leave it there. Folks will be able to. When we post this show, usually about the end of today, folks can go to the link kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour and get this information. But where else can they get it?
The link that I just gave them, or genderf-k.com.
The gender F, or just
genderf-k.com. Thank you for confusing the audience.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
And, you know, of course, the Google machine will take you there if you throw in a few cool keywords. So.
Yeah. And we're on Facebook, too. We're really easy to find.
Yes.
The Queer Caucus and TSA and What the Gender F and everything.
Awesome. Thank you both, Evan Birchfield, Juliet Milan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will have you back. You must.
Absolutely.
Must come back. All right. Excellent. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye. Old Mole Variety Hour.